Hey, good morning. I guess you can hear me. Tim has sort of already let me off the hook as far as this first slide. Hey, what am I doing here? I'm not an expert on PDP at all. But I think there's some common ground that can be established, and I hope that PDP experts and indeed Jay will find various things to relate to in this talk. Of course, PDP made a huge impact because it was the first theory that really learned things and learned things in a serious way. It was really quite revolutionary, and a lot of the revolutionary work was about language, which is, of course, my area. If I could maybe start with just a little bit of anthropology, the role of linguistics in cognitive science. I have this dread that the linguists are thought of as the people who take the hardline nativist views on language acquisition. I think this is a little bit of a stereotype, and indeed my own views are kind of a little bit more middle of the road on this issue. If you look at the field as it views itself, I think the core value of the field is obsession with linguistic data and the patterning of that data. If you go to a linguistics talk, the part where the audience kind of sits up and takes notice is the data section, because they're all thinking about how they would analyze the data themselves. Okay. Just a little bit of linguistics, in fact, generative linguistics. Chomsky, in his early work, laid out the problem, I think, in a pretty persuasive way. The logical problem of language acquisition is kind of the core problem of theoretical linguistics. The premise, which I think I hardly need to defend in a context like this one, is that language acquisition is just an extraordinary feat. The speed with which it's done, the detail of what is learned, the difficulty of doing it with unsupervised learning, so on and so forth. And the explanation that Chomsky put forth is that there's a universal grammar, right, that the child brings some kind of a priori knowledge to the task, and we couple this with learning mechanisms. The UG, I should immediately emphasize, comes in two varieties, which you might call hard UG, where you actually put grammatical principles in the genome. I'm very intrigued by this prospect, but I feel it's not yet proven. There's soft UG, aspects of language that are shaped by human nature in some way. For instance, the view widespread among phonologists that the grammatical principles of the phonology are somehow guided by phonetic considerations like ease of articulation, ease of perception. Now, what I just laid out is, I love this term that Nico just said, a verbal theory. You know, kind of sort of qualitatively say what's going on. How could we move beyond a verbal theory? Well, that's where modeling kicks in. And this is the kind of modeling that I and various other people in the field have started doing in the last 10 years or so. I think it's a change in the field. So here's what you do. You get a learning model, perhaps with some UG in it. You get a data corpus designed as best as you can to reflect what kids are hearing as they acquire language. The model digests the data, produces a grammar, and then you test the grammar. The way you test the grammar is, in principle, to have it be the nth experimental subject in experiments that are otherwise given to people. And if you have a sufficiently detailed series of experiments that obsesses sufficiently on the data pattern of the language, as I mentioned earlier, you might actually be in a good position to see if your models are doing what we hope. The modeling that I'll talk about, this is all stuff that I've been doing with collaborators. What it uses is constraint-based grammars. Constraints are, in fact, kind of the common currency of linguistic theory in all areas. The virtue of using the constraints is that you get access to key ideas of linguistic theory, which, of course, were invented in confrontation with data. And in addition, constraint-based learning systems are very easy to diagnose, right? You know pretty much exactly how the model is doing, what it does, and where it's going wrong. These constraints, and here's where it's a little bit novel within linguistics, the constraints are the same constraints that linguists in general are using, but they are embedded in a quantitative framework. Currently, I'm using Maxent grammars. In Maxent grammars, every constraint is affiliated with a weight, and you use a simple mathematical formula that takes the weights, the violations of the constraints, and you end up assigning probabilities to your candidate outcomes. More complicated math is used to set the weights during learning, using, indeed, quite a bit of the same math used in PDP. So a question really for linguists, why deploy the constraints in a quantitative model? My answer is maybe a bit over the top. I would say the data demand it, that language is just filled with gradients in every area. The use of non-gradient models in linguistics might, now I'm being outright aggressive, be thought of as a holdover from the earlier heuristic phase of the field, where I think it was a quite legitimate research idealization. But the field is maturing, and I think it's we're ready to move to this next step. Now, here's the actual content of the talk. What emerges when modeling is combined with experimentation? And I want to suggest three things. The model might learn more than the linguists have detected. The model might provide a different interpretation of an experiment than the experimentalists have proposed. And lastly, the model might work better when you put some UG in it. So those three things. As far as the model learning more than the linguists detected, I'd like to put forth the phenomenon of islands of reliability, kind of pleasant tropical islands. Here's an example. Suppose you're trying to predict the past tense of an English verb from the present tense. Here's the observation. English has about 350 verbs that end in voiceless fricatives. That's f, th, s, sh, and every one of them is regular. This fact was, I encountered this fact in the course of modeling. With Adam Albright, we put together a quantitative model for morphological and phonological learning. And like everybody else, we couldn't resist applying it to the English past tense data. We fed the model about 4,000 present past pairs, and it learned a whole bunch of constraints, things like if the present is like this, the past has to be like this. And one of the ones it learned was verbs ending in a voiceless fricative have to take ED, phonetically T. The model, not Maxent, but quantitative, evaluates every such mapping constraint, and it values scope and it values accuracy. This turns out to be a great mapping. It's 100% accurate, and it has 350 examples. So that's a fact about the English lexicon, that this pattern exists. What about English speakers? Do they internalize it? Do they know it? So of course, we did a WUG test. We made up verbs, some of them in islands, some of them not in islands, and we got ratings data from participants. And what emerged is that the participants were really happy with the regular outcome for these islands. So they loved Blaeft, Whist, Tesht, and so on. And we did our statistics and found that this couldn't be accounted for simply by looking at competitor forms like Blof. Similar islands exist in English and in other languages. Upshot. It looks like people really do know more than what is taught to freshmen in intro linguistics, where you learn just one rule for the regulars. And in fact, this view taken very seriously by Pinker in his book, Words and Rules. So that's sort of a smaller point, but the general point for which I would assert quite a bit of other work done along these lines. Traditional linguistics underestimates what people know about their language. In particular, it underestimates the incredibly detailed quantitative characterization that people have in their heads. Okay, on to the second point. The model might provide a different interpretation of an experiment than the experimentalists proposed. Here, I want to talk about a really cool phenomenon that's been the subject of interest from several experimenters recently, the so-called sonority hierarchy projection effect. The idea, Berant and others, is that this is possibly a UG effect, people exhibiting knowledge that they could not have learned from the surrounding data when they were kids. A bit about sonority. Sonority is roughly acoustic intensity of a consonant, and if you look around the world's languages, quite characteristically, a consonant cluster will have the more sonorous consonant next to the vowel. So zillions of languages have syllables like tra. If you take a slightly less sonorant sound like n, that's not such a good sonority profile. They're too, T and m are too close, and not very many languages have tm. Take a tie like mn, and it gets rarer still. A modest sonority reversal like LM, and it's rarer still. And the really horrible case that only a very small number of languages have is a gross sonority reversal like LB. What about, here's the scheme. Look at clusters that don't exist in English, but vary in how egregious the violation of the sonority principle is, and see how people rate them. Okay, this is going backwards in time, a very recent work that is following up on work that I'm just about to cite. But my UCLA colleague Robert DeLand and a bunch of grad students were all working together on experiments in this area. And here's the crucial thing. You see on the horizontal axis an arrangement of sonority profiles going from not so bad to really horrible, and on the vertical axis, the ratings data. So you can see they're systematically getting worse. Not just in our data, rating studies of Albright, and indeed, Behrendt's work with her colleagues involved perception and production data, but arriving at the same conclusion. Now, so the argument for UG based on the sonority projection effect is all of these clusters are zero frequency. So if it was just induction from the ambient data, you would expect that they would be rated identically. So that's the argument. But what about modeling? In recent years, I've put together with Colin Wilson a computational model for phonotactics. That's phonological well-formedness. What it does is you feed it a database consisting simply of the words of the language in phonetic transcription. It inductively discovers constraints, and it weights these constraints by Maxent principles. And this produces a grammar that will assign a well-formedness value to any novel string. So with DeLand and the students, we've been using this model to see if it makes predictions about this experiment. We trained the model in 18,000 English words, and we tested it with the same forms that we gave the experimental participants. Glossing over a lot of complications, it seems to be working. Not perfectly, but at least at the qualitative level, the model is predicting sonority projection. How does it do it? Well, it does know a little bit in advance. It has phonological features, right? The core idea of phonological representation. These features represent sonority in that there is one feature for each cutoff on the sonority hierarchy. The result then seems to be that it is not necessarily proven that people need to have an innate sonority sequencing principle in order to behave the way they do on these experiments. Merely knowing features that represent sonority may make it possible to learn the pattern generalizing from the existing clusters that English has, like TR. Last point. The model might work better when you put some UG in it. This is work in progress that I'm doing with Jamie White, a grad student at UCLA. Here's the story. Phonologists analyze lots and lots of languages the world over, and they use constraints to analyze them. And what is really striking is that you can use the same constraints to analyze different languages because you see the same phenomena all over the place. Indeed, it is a widespread view that the constraints are part of the language faculty. The radical view would be that there's some kind of list, but another sort of soft UG variant is that the language learner can figure out these constraints because they're the ones that are phonetically effective in facilitating articulation and perception. So with White, our goal was to test a very peculiar behavior of the Hayes-Wilson model. The Hayes-Wilson model does pretty well at finding the constraints that linguists find for the phonotactics of languages, but it also finds quite a few other constraints that look very puzzling to an experienced phonologist. They have no phonetic support, no typological support. Nevertheless, they fit the data of English very well. They have none or few exceptions. So we decided to figure out what's going on with the speakers for these constraints, and we made up a simple nonce-probe study. The test forms came in four varieties. Something like Knif with an FL cluster violates a very natural constraint on sonority sequencing. It's paired with Knift as a control. Something like Fauschert violates a constraint that is true for English, but seems to have no plausible basis. It forbids diphthongs before palato-alveolar fricatives. It's paired with Fauschert, which obeys the constraint. So we got ratings data using magnitude estimation, simultaneous spoken and orthographic input. Here's the way it came out. When a test form violated a natural constraint like Knif, the participants rated it as horrible, as you'd expect. And, of course, the control form is rated as just fine. For these unnatural constraints that have no typological or phonetic support, the speakers are rating them essentially as the same. There's a small difference, but it's not significant. So what does this mean? The experimental result for us is really just the starting point, right? So we found it looks like the Hayes-Wilson model is in trouble in this respect. How would you fix it? And the fixes that we're considering are of two kinds. One is information theoretic. Is there something that we could do statistically with the data processing being different that would enable it to distinguish the good constraints from the ones that are causing the trouble? We've tried a lot of things, and so far it's not working. We're open to further ideas. But what does seem to be working is to put in a little bit of UG in it. We took a theory by Doncasteriotti about how phonetics determines naturalness and phonological constraints, put together a little script that generates a few thousand constraints that are all phonetically natural in this sense, and let the model select from them. This is getting the bias that it needs, and indeed is getting a much better fit to the data. Thus, our tentative conclusion is that the ratings in the experiment reflect not just learning from the existing lexicon of English, but some kind of phonetic bias that could be fairly characterized as a UG principle. Well, that's almost the end of the talk, but since I have a bunch of cognitive scientists gathered before me, I thought I might take the opportunity to not quite rant, but to make some practical suggestions. And I think actually PDP people might find these suggestions, be in sympathy with them as well. So here we go. I would love to see more experiments that are linked to models. Okay. There are so many experiments in which the theory is only a verbal theory. But I would see two virtues in having more experiments that are linked to models. One is that the models can let you pick your stimuli in a way that most directly tests your hypothesis. That, in fact, was true for all three experiments that I've described here. And of course, the models avoid vagueness in interpreting the results. You don't have to say, we would predict, which is a very frequent phrase used. If you look on that on Google, we would predict. We really want to say, we do predict. At least with this model, we do predict. Okay, so that's the first bit of the sermon. The others are sort of more humble. People doing modeling work often look at the experimental literature and find stuff that they would love to try to model, but the data just aren't there. The forms are not transcribed in IPA. The individual participant data are not given. This would be something really easy to fix simply by posting them on the web. And on the other side of the table, what about the modelers? It is inevitable that when you do a computational model, the software that emerges first is messy, accident-prone, and highly user-unfriendly. It's a lot of work to turn them into something that could be downloaded from the internet and used by experimentalists and other modelers. But if you did this, it would make the models both widely usable and more testable. That's it. Thank you.
I just wonder to what extent you view the constraints that you use in your work as sort of useful conceptual tools versus sort of, you know, let's say, I hate to use the term real, but, you know, real mechanisms that, you know, are sort of accurately describing the way that we're going about showing sensitivity to the different graded constraints.
Well, at some level, of course, any kind of symbolic cognitive science is not real because in the end it's all, I mean, I guess a million people have said this, it's all cashed out in neurons. On the other hand, given what we've been able to do in understanding language and finding the structural patterns in language, it's just really striking how categorical, how amenable, I mean, this is the thing that really grabs people, I think, when they first come to linguistics, is how analyzable language is. So, you know, given that point of view, I think that in the long run, we're going to find neural correlates to linguistic theoretical constructs. Yeah.
Thank you.